Hello, it's the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and we have an amazing, truly wonderful guest today, and I will get to her in just a moment. First, I want to thank the people who make this possible. This episode is sponsored by MailChimp. MailChimp celebrates creativity, chaos, and teamwork. More than 4 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to send email newsletters. I'm one of them. Their product's fantastic. A Book Apart uses it, and A Better Part uses it. Mule Radio uses it. I wouldn't be caught dead sending mail with anything else. It makes me sad when I send a personal email because it's not as cool as MailChimp. That's what I think. And they're just great. So if you're interested and you think you have any business reason to send email, go to MailChimp.com to learn more. That's MailChimp.com. I don't know why I did that. With no further ado, I would like to introduce our guest today. She's the author of Self-Portrait as Your Trader, a very personal book of design essays and drawings with an introduction by Paula Scheer. She's the author of four other design books as well. She's been in the design field for 25 years. She is a pioneering internet radio broadcaster. Beginning in 2005, she hosted the first weekly radio talk show about design on the whole internet, which she continues, and that was independent. She continues it today at the Design Observer. In her day job, she is the design president of Sterling Brands, and at night, she runs the brand MFA department at School of Visual Arts in New York, which is a division of School of Visual Arts that I believe she started. So there's lots to talk about, lots to talk about. Debbie, thanks for coming on and welcome.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's so wonderful to be with you today.
You and I have talked before on internet radio, but it was on your show.
Yes, it was. And it was quite a long time ago when my sound was really dreadful. Thank you for doing it way back when.
You were in the Empire State Building, right?
Yes. So I was actually able to say live, recording live from the Empire State Building.
That is so cool.
Which was you know, most of the radio stations that say live from the Empire State Building aren't really live from the Empire State Building. They just have the tower and the antenna in the Empire State Building.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's really true. There are all the radio stations that you hear that say live from the Empire State Building are really just have their antenna on the roof of the Empire State Building.
I don't really listen to radio. Do you? I mean, aside from internet radio, it's like this. Do you really?
I still listen to NPR, and I still have a mad crush on Terry Gross, and probably always will.
Although it's questionable if that's actually radio. NPR is almost its own thing. It's like saying, I don't read the paper. I read the New York Times, but I'll read the paper. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. What's interesting is that, speaking of antennas, I do have a car, but someone broke the antenna off my car years ago. And I went to try and get it fixed, and the Honda dealership told me that in order to fix it, I would have to take the entire roof off the car. And
that's good design.
Exactly.
That's good design.
And I decided that it really was more expensive than I wanted to pay to fix the radio. But I ended up getting a Sirius radio. It cost me $8 a month, and I get NPR all the time. So it's perfect.
That is perfect. When do you think internet radio shows like this, do you think that they will, are some already on Sirius or XM radio? I don't know myself, but it seems like Sirius, right, was a new business model like 15 years ago, right? It's like, it doesn't have to be broadcast. People can subscribe. It was kind of like the cable, what cable was to TV, Sirius was to over-the-air broadcast radio, right?
Yes, yes.
But I
don't know that we have the same kind of diverse, serious content. Most of the stations that I listen to or that I go through as I'm looking for something to listen to on Sirius tend to be aggregates of like best of the 90s, best of the 80s, best of the 20s. Whereas cable, you have, you know, it's evolved into such a great art form with so many amazing shows on so many amazing channels. And even the free channels now have incredible content.
Right.
I think that you see more of that incredible content in podcasting.
That's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. So here, on the one hand, they have this distribution channel that's in, like, everyone's car.
Right, with pretty crappy content.
Right. And here we have this renaissance of audio content that's been happening for about, well, since about 2005, let's say, on the internet.
Right.
Well, but it's still, it's not like I'm driving and can listen to internet radio.
Exactly. And what
let's put that together. How can
let's do that. Because the nice thing about, the nice thing that still happens when you're listening to radio is discovery. And so even though you might not be expecting to find anything, if you are going channel to channel to channel to channel, every now and then you do find something really interesting to listen to. And I still like that.
I do too, although the twist that the internet, so if you're like a member of Spotify, the twist that the internet throws on that is that it actually knows what else I like, and it'll say, right, you were listening to MF Doom, so you might like to hear this album by this other artist, right? Because that's kind of cool. And that doesn't happen on radio. Radio is more still mass.
But that is also something that I like, because the Spotify's and the Pandora's, there's an algorithm that allows them to understand what you might like in that particular genre. But what about range? People have much broader range. And that's one of the things that I like about just discovering. I was on Wikipedia the other day, and I was thinking, Wikipedia needs to have a next page button. So what's the next thing that would come alphabetically after the thing you're looking at, or the thing before? So you can learn new things. The thing about the internet, the thing about...
Oh, like an encyclopedia that you're flipping
exactly,
through.
Exactly, exactly. Is that I want to be surprised more. I want to go to things that I don't know about.
Right, or even like you get an architecture book to find out about a building you're going to see, but then you flip through it and read the building next, you know, the building on the page before or the page after, or you came to look at this one building, but the photo is so arresting of another building that you end up reading about that, and the next thing you know, you've read a whole chapter, and all that fortuitousness. The way I did that on Spotify was, first, I had a really large collection of my own, and I basically let Spotify know everything that I had, and I continued to listen to all kinds of stuff that they didn't have, but I would find stuff that they had that was in my interest, like in what am I diverse. If you have diverse listening habits on Spotify, then it won't just typecast you. But I don't know how many people have diverse listening habits. Remember when we were kids and you had to just listen to one thing,
I still remember having to decide what album I was going to get with the $5 I'd saved up from my allowance when I was in the seventh grade. And I had to decide between, now I'm going to not only date myself, but I'm also going to shame myself. I had to decide between Olivia Newton-John and Elton John. And I fantasized that they were related.
It's really the same person.
But, so I had to decide because I didn't have enough money for both. But when I was a kid, I used to listen to...
I have to know who you picked.
I'm embarrassed. I'm so embarrassed. Okay. I picked Olivia Newton-John. And then the next week, I actually ended up... I got Captain Fantastic the following week. But when I was...
You know what? I'm so much older than you. I could really terrify you.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. It was the first album I bought for myself was Disraeli Gears by Cream.
Nice.
There's
nothing to be ashamed of about that. Nothing.
Oh, I would have picked. I would have bought something by the Monkees, but the guy at the record store shamed me and said, "You don't want that. You want this. You don't want that. You want this."
But I used to listen to Top 40 radio, and I cut out the top 40 Billboard list that was published in Newsday every Sunday. And I'd spend the rest of the week furiously listening to all the music and checking off each song as I listened, because I wanted to make sure I knew every single song in the top 40.
That's interesting. And you've interviewed every designer in the top 100, 200, 300. That's kind of a natural transition, right? How did you... when you began doing internet radio before it was called podcasting, which it doesn't have to be called, but when you were doing that, had you already worked with a lot of people? I mean, what made you think, I'd like to, you know, it would be really cool to talk to Chip Kidd, and I bet there's people who'd like to hear me talk to Chip Kidd. How did that come about?
It came about completely serendipitously. There was no plan. There was no ambition. I wasn't pining away in my apartment, hoping someday I would be discovered on the radio. One day, somebody in my office got a cold call about hearing someone that they thought worked at Sterling, reading about somebody that they thought worked at Sterling on a blog, which was Speak Up. And she put the call through to me, and they were interested. I got essentially cold called to see if I would be at all interested in doing a radio show on design on Voice America, which was a fledgling internet radio network back in 2000. They approached me in 2004. I got very, very excited until they told me that, no, not only would they not be paying me, but in order to do this, I actually had to pay them, that they would be producing the show for me. They would have it on the air for me, but I had to pay them to do that. All the content would be something that I directed. And was I interested?
And who would own the copyright on that?
I would still own the copyright.
And you have that material still, or did they sort of, if when they went away, take the material with them?
No, what happened was they were all digital files, so I had them all. I was able to have them right away, and I put them up on Sterling's website as well. But back then, I really didn't have a wide range of design friends that I could pull from. I decided that it would be worth it to pay the money to do this. I thought it would be really fun. I had absolutely no idea if it would go beyond the 13 episodes that I contracted them to do. It cost about $5,000 or $6,000, and I thought, you know,
wow.
Yeah, it was expensive, but you know what? I decided I work really hard. I have a very good job, and I thought, you know what? Everything that I've been doing up until that point in my life from a career perspective had been highly commercial. I was desperate to do something more creative. I was desperate to do something that I had complete control over, in that I was running the content, that I didn't have to have approval from clients, that I didn't have to have rejections from clients. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this because I can, and I want to, and it's sort of a dream, even though I didn't even know it was a dream. And so I called my friends at that point, the friends that I had, like an AIGA New York chapter, and John Fulbrook was my first guest, and Cheryl Swanson was my second. And basically, the first five or six were just friends that were willing to take a chance, and I was really, really nervous. And those early shows, I've taken off the air because they're just so dreadful. I was so nervous, and I had written comments, and I interviewed John Fulbrick about his job at that point, which was the creative director at Simon & Schuster, and I had notes taped all over my office walls and books propped up on the windowsills to refer to, and he was just a real trooper. I knew one of the reasons I asked John Fulbrick to do it was that he's a very talkative, very vibrant personality, and I thought, if I choke, he can take over.
That was smart.
Yeah.
Well, you have a good survival skill.
And
right.
I think so. I hope so. I've survived this far. I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to say that I relate very much to the story, because, I mean, that's what the internet did for me, too. When I discovered the web before that, it was 10 years earlier, but it was the same thing. I was doing creative work that was getting rejected and rejected and rejected, and the idea that I could just control what I published. I mean, I had a wonderful client, my first web client, and I loved it, and I didn't ever wanted to look back. I wanted to keep doing stuff for web clients.
But who was your web client back then?
Donald Buckley from Warner Brothers. They wanted to do a website for Batman. Netscape 1.1 had just come out.
Netscape.
Yeah, there's, but he was really brilliant. He was, you know, I'd looked at the web and I thought, well, this will never beat AOL. AOL is so much cuter and cuddlier. I mean, if you think about what the web looked like in 1995, for anyone remotely interested in design to jump on that bus seems very strange in hindsight because it was so limited.
Yeah.
But it was publishing. It was control. It was find your audience. It was DIY. It was all the things that we love and weren't able to do in our professional jobs up till then.
Absolutely. And I think that ultimately it was only because other people were interested in that content at that time that I even continued to do it. Had no one listened, had no one given me any feedback, had it been in just a little vacuum that was just all about serving my own soul, I don't know that I would have continued. But I got such a positive response from people, and I just decided I would go until I wouldn't be able to get any more guests, and I'm still going.
So. You did 100 episodes independently.
I did 100 episodes on Voice America, where I paid them to host the show on their site. And then I decided to leave Voice America because the world was catching up, podcasts were taking off, and they didn't have the quality of sound that I felt that I needed. And in fact, the only criticism that I was getting about the show was the sound quality. Right. And it originally was started on a telephone line. I was doing my interviews with people on a telephone. Even when I was doing them face to face, I was facing them and we each had a handset. So then when I started working at SVA, SVA was building a floor for the Masters in Branding program. And I knew that people like Liz Danzico and Alice Twemlow had podcast studios in their departments, and thought that I might be able to manage to get one myself. And they said yes. And so I've been doing my podcasts at the School of Visual Arts in my Masters in Branding studio ever since.
Did it blow your mind when people were, again, because like talk about 2004, before you do this, you're successful, you've been in business, I don't know, 15 years, let's say, but you have some frustrations and you don't really know everyone. And now, just a few short years later, they're building a floor for a program that you created. And you're thinking, maybe I could get a podcasting studio. Does it blow your mind the way that you threw yourself into something, just believed in it and took a chance on yourself and spent some of your own money on yourself, and that, you know, a few years later, you know everyone and you've got this amazing department that you're creating so that you're able to bring your knowledge. You're able to talk like up and down and sideways. You're able to talk to a design legend that's 100 years old, and then you're able to talk to a 25-year-old student. And you know what I mean? Doesn't this kind of blow your mind that it all started with these podcasts, these –
Every day. I was thinking yesterday that I hoped that I wouldn't wake up one day and it would be 1988 and I would still be miserable. And I would still have, I mean, I've talked about this a bit because it's still so foreign to me and so incredible to me that I felt that I've been working now. I graduated from college in 1983, so it's my 30th year of working. And the first 20 were essentially exercises in rejection and despair. And it's quite astonishing to me how it all turned around. And I still don't know how it happened, and still, thank the stars every single day, because it just doesn't feel possible after all that this could be happening.
That gratitude is great, and I'm grateful to her too. I had also like 20 years of what the F am I doing, and mm-hmm. all that, just being underemployed and overlooked, the last person who would get promoted, never having a clue how to do anything social that would advance my career. Thinking I was a good partner and then having my partner angry at me and I didn't know why. Like every class, but all those classic mistakes make me so much better today. And I sometimes feel bad for people. I mean, I had a boss during the dot-com era, and he's a great guy and he's still very active on the internet. He's a wonderful guy, but he'd started a dot-com company when he was 19. He'd never worked as a dishwasher. He'd never worked as like a junior art director or copywriter. You know what I mean? He'd never delivered laundry and had someone yell at him in a language he didn't understand because there was a stain on their clothes. I mean, he never had these terrible experiences, which are formative and great, because you look back and you go, well, I know how I want to treat employees. I know how I know what I struggled through, and I would want to make sure that everyone's, you know, has a fair deal. I know how I want to treat other people. All the stuff that you learn, I want to respect the client, and, you know, because I learned all that stuff that you learn is good. So I think all that rejection helped make you maybe the person you are. Well,
oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. And I actually firmly, with my whole heart, believe that had all of that rejection not happened, then I wouldn't actually have been able to create whatever success that I have. And so much so that one of my recent talks is called On Rejection, How the Worst Moments of My Life Turned Out to Be the Best, because it was after a cumulative and a fairly hefty cumulative series of rejections that when I actually felt that maybe it was time to reconsider everything that I was doing, that at that moment, things really began to change. And for anybody that's ever felt like there was no hope, but you still have hope, or there was no chance, but you still have hope, then there is still a big fat chance that you will get everything you hope.
Absolutely. Although it's really important, probably for both of us, I don't think you want to say, yeah, I want what Debbie Millman has, so I'm gonna do what she did to try to get that result.
Well, if they want to go through 20 or 30, you know, 20 years of constant rejection, like, go for it. But there are other ways that are probably a lot easier.
You're unusual also, although I think I do this too. You're able to speak personally, and you're able to, so you have like, you'll write about design, and you write about design ideas and talk to people about design, but you can also be very upfront about what's going on inside your soul, and you find ways to express that, whether in a presentation or like in your latest book. Do you ever worry about that? Do you ever worry that you're exposing too much or that people will?
You know something? I don't anymore. I mean, I used to be the kind of person that didn't want to leave the house without wearing makeup because I'd feel so vulnerable and exposed. And I mean that sincerely. I was very ashamed of a lot of what I perceived as failures or insufficiency. And I don't know if it comes with age. I suspect that it does. I think once you hit your 50s, you feel ever so slightly more comfortable in your skin, and thank God for that. But I don't – it's really interesting. I was watching an old TED Talk by Brené Brown where she talks about how – shame is such a debilitating emotion, and that it's so inner driven and it's so paralyzing that once you sort of deal with that intensity and that self-sabotage, it becomes a little bit easier to be authentic because you no longer are as worried about people discovering something that you no longer realize will kill you. and so I think that's part of it.
You let it out. You air it out.
But I also, and I do think that this has come with 200 plus interviews with other people and realizing that there's so many common denominators in our experience of shame and in our experience of inadequacy and that sort of phony fear thing that people have about thinking that they're just
not good enough,
that I don't feel as I don't feel like I need to hide it as much because I feel like everybody feels it. And
I feel that every day. And I wouldn't want to be a designer who thought they were great. That must really be, you know, like, who are you kidding?
I am astonished by people like that. And I kind of admire them because I think, wouldn't it be amazing to wake up one day and make it through an entire day without any self-doubt, or to actually feel like, wow, I am, what is that Stuart Smalley says? You know, I am good.
I'm good enough.
I am good enough. Like, I would love to feel that. And I kind of admire people that feel that way, but I honestly feel that most people that project that, I find that it is not maybe quite as sincere as they'd like people to believe it is. The only people that I really feel have that sincerely, of all the people I've ever interviewed, are Massimo Vignelli and Milton Glaser. And I think it's because they're in their 80s.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, by the time in your 80s, like, fuck it, man, I'm just who I am. And if you don't like it, then find someone else. And I think that that's, like, I aspire to that. I do.
I know. It's something to look forward to. Aside from all the things you don't look forward to at that age.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Because it's sort of terrible that you get to be comfortable in your own skin and then your own skin is kind of wrinkly.
But that's everything's set up wrong.
Exactly.
Everything's set up wrong. I was I'm a middle-aged parent and I love that. And I think of what my parents, you know, if my parents made mistakes, they were also in their 20s when they had kids.
Yeah.
How do you do that? And most people, that's the experience. And I feel blessed that all the nastiness and self-centeredness and a lot of that has gone away. And I may, you know what I mean? In my life for whatever, you know, just through time beating it out of you or experience beating it out of you. And it's kind of, I mean, it's probably nice to, you know, to be, have as much energy as your kid, you know, that would be nice. But on the flip side, I have more maturity than my kid and I think I'm supposed to, and that's kind of a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that I did when I was 20. So.
But I love how great of a dad you are. I mean, you're probably like, how the hell do you know what kind of a dad I am? But I see you on Facebook and I see the things that you're doing with your daughter and I just love it. I love it. Well, you probably could see by how many times I like your little sort of vignettes about what you're doing. So,
well, thank you. Yeah. It seems like the most meaningful thing, you know, that's happened. So for me, this amazing person. So yeah, I mean, I love it. And it's, I don't know, she's sick today. She's sick today, and I spent the morning with her. And, you know, sometimes I could just fall asleep just by the nearness of my kid because she's safe. It's a weird, thing, but I think all of us are soldiers in a way. All of us have people that we feel protective toward. And we'd do anything for. And I have people like that in my life, too, and I'm so grateful for them. Just a few. But there are people I know would jump into a bullet for me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hold on to them dearly.
Yeah. Try not to piss them off.
I hope your daughter feels better.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm sure if she doesn't, she'll give me what she has, and it'll equalize anyway. So 4 books, right? That you've written, five?
Sort of depends on how you categorize them. I've written 4 books. Self-Portrait is my 5th. And I also edited a book that my students wrote. And so I don't know where to put that or how to count that. So numerous.
Which one is that?
That's Brand Bible.
When did that come out?
Brand Bible came out. It was my first year of teaching the Masters in Branding program. I had an opportunity through Emily Potts at Rockport to do a book. They wanted to do a book on branding, sort of a textbook or a history of branding. And it's the it's a book that is about creating, building, designing, and sustaining brands. And one of the faculty in the branding program, a wonderful, brilliant man named Richard Scheer, has a history class that he teaches. And so he starts all the way back with like Louis XIV and Queen Elizabeth. And he talks about how branding is a way of very deliberate differentiation. And that's been going on for millennia. And so we use the framework in his class. And my inaugural year of branding students wrote this book. And it's starts in the 1400s and goes all the way through till 2011 when the book came out.
That's amazing.
And I edited the book. The students really wrote it. So
teaching sounds like it's just a great thing for you.
I love teaching. And I love imbuing my students with as much confidence as I can and with the notion that they can create their lives to be whatever they want them to be. And I think by the time you get to college, and certainly by the time you get to graduate school, your own self-imposed limitations are set. And I like to try to shatter those with my students. And
how do you do that?
By pushing them to reconsider the limitations and by helping them understand what makes them special and helping to create a sense in them intrinsically that they are smart. I had a teacher that did that for me when I was in college. I came to college. My first year of college, I was, and this is in 1979, 1980, I almost left college my first semester because I was so lonely and I felt like I was completely over my head in these giant lecture halls. And I went to SUNY Albany, so it wasn't like I was intimidated by the brilliant students at Harvard or anything. And I ended up, my folks ended up sort of encouraging me to stick it out, and I'm glad I did. But in my sophomore year of school, I very accidentally came across a professor named Helen Ruggiero Elam, and she used to sit cross-legged on her desk in the classroom with a thermos of tea, and she would engage in these conversations about literature and about life. And if anybody came up with something that she thought was, I would imagine now, even remotely interesting, she would make you feel like $1 million. And she'd say, oh my God, that's brilliant. And we'd talk, and she imbued confidence in people, and she changed my life. I went from this scaredy cat, little chubby girl in my sophomore year to a not so scaredy cat, chubby girl.
Cool.
But she taught me something really important, which was if somebody believes in you, you can begin to believe in yourself. And so if I believe in my students, and I really try to very hard to find something that is very, very intrinsically meaningful about them, then if I can see it and feel it, then maybe they can too. And that's a very big part of how I teach.
The connection with the students is so intense and personal. I don't know if they know. I mean, do you think your students know how much you care about them?
I think some of them do, absolutely. I don't want to say that I'm hard on them, but I have very high expectations. In fact, one of the students, a woman that graduated in our first year, I've been mentoring her, sort of unofficially mentoring her since she graduated. And she's at a point now in her life where she's thinking about her next job. And she's a real superstar. But, you know, whatever happens in any corporation, you know, you go in and, you know, there are people that might think differently than you or feel that you're not as amazing as you thought you were, or you're more amazing than you thought you were. And you come out and you're, you know, you're just not entirely sure who you are anymore. And that's part of the process of any career here.
Yep.
And you know, thinking about another job, and I am urging her to not take just the next thing that comes along to get out of a place that you're in that might not make you happy, because there's always going to be something that doesn't make you happy, but you have to really try to hold out for something that is worthy of what you can provide.
That's really wonderful advice. And you were in advertising, right?
No, I mean, I have been in design and branding for pretty much my whole career. I've never actually worked in an advertising agency.
So brand agencies.
Brand agencies and design agencies for my entire career. Very early on, I worked in a magazine, but then my second job was working in a marketing firm, actually in a real estate firm as a marketing director, which was the lowest point of my life career-wise, and then started freelance design work and then just went straight through to design and branding for the remainder of until now. You know, I'm also teaching.
Your advice is very to the student is very good, because one thing I discovered, I was in advertising before the internet, and which is where you can end up if you don't know what you're doing and you failed at five other things already. But where you go determines how you're seen, and each job is a choice that limits your future career or opens new possibilities to your future career. And you don't,
absolutely.
When you're like 20 something and you're just like, you need to make a buck. You're like, well, there's a job, or I don't like my boss, so I'm going to go across the street, make the same money, work on this other thing. And you don't realize that now you've worked at two hack shops, nobody will ever hire you. I mean, I remember headhunters saying, like, throw out your portfolio. It's terrible. I made a new one myself, like, you know, spent some money, spent the money on myself to make the portfolio that I should have had, came back. They said, this is great. You're still not going to get hired because you worked at these places. You're going to have to take, you're going to have to work at compromised places for the remainder of your career, no matter what. And the only way I was able to get out of that was to go to really great places where they basically paid almost no salary, like take this immense pay cut. And, you know, the internet, as it happened, came along and saved me. But if I'd been a little more successful in advertising, I don't know. I might be dead of liver failure by now. You know what I mean? I don't really know. So the choice that you make about a job is really important. I'm also mentoring a former MFA student in the interaction design program at SVA, unofficially mentoring. And like, she's sort of in a situation, too, where by, you know, a job possibility where the next job is very important. I'll just say that, where the next job is very important, and it's important to take time and make the right choice. And that can be really hard. There's tremendous pressures on people. And people sometimes take a job because, you know, my boyfriend's moving and I want to move with my boyfriend. And so I'm going to take this, you know, I mean, there's, which after the relationship ends, people can be like super bitter about, wow, I moved for that guy, and now, you know, now I'm working at a pharmaceutical house.
Yeah, I also, I made, my second job choice was made because I was going to be making a little bit more money than I had been making at my previous job. And I was also really intimidated by somebody that was on sort of the same track as I was, and she scared the daylights out of me, and I thought that I'd never measure up to her, and I might as well just leave. And I think that people make a lot of decisions because of money in terms of their career. And you can't, I mean, I fully understand what it means to have to pay your own way.
Right.
And when I was in my 20s, I actually had three jobs because I couldn't pay my own way, and I had nobody that was helping me pay my way. And if you have to take a job that isn't going to pay you enough money, but you love that job and you love that work, then you have to figure out a way to supplement what you're doing on the weekends or at night or in a separate freelance effort, in an effort to make your way. Do not leave something you like because you don't make enough money for something that you're going to get more money for that you won't love as much, because you will be miserable.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
The other thing that I really, you know, it's so interesting. I do so much lecturing and talking to students. And I had a student in an audience a couple of months ago ask me about blogging. And she wanted some advice because she was very dismayed about the fact that she had been blogging and couldn't seem to get any traction and couldn't seem to get any followers or people to comment on the things that she was writing. And I asked her how long she'd been doing it, and she very sincerely, without missing a beat, Jeffrey, looked at me and said, about a month. And I was like, call me in a year. You know? But wow. I think that, you know, we're living in a 140 character world, and people expect immediate results. And I feel very much the way you did when you said before that you're glad that it happened for you later in life. I do as well, because I think the later it happens, the longer it lasts. And I feel that people that make it very, very quickly don't maybe have quite the right resources to sustain it or to handle it and or to plan it or to plan with it. And so I think that when I was, I tell people, you know, be the first person in the office, the last person to leave, work harder than anybody that you know, that you work with or that you know, and then see what happens before starting to complain or to feel dismayed.
It's totally true. And yet, if you've just, you know, if you've just invested if you're in a design track, and you've just invested in your education and spent a lot of money and time on it, and worked with brilliant teachers and had brilliant guest lecturers, and, you know, this is the era of Facebook, you kind of have this, even if you're not the kind of person who feels entitled normally, there's kind of a natural expectation that you're going to walk into an amazing job and make a difference right away. And 1 in 1,000 people finishing a master's program or whatever are going to, their next job will be amazing and they'll make a huge difference.
Right.
You may work at an amazing place and have a terrible job too. That's the other thing, you know.
Yeah.
You could go to Twitter and be designer number 37 at Twitter. And I don't know what you'd be working on. Maybe finding a different way to make the line that connects two related comments.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That might be your job. And I'm not mocking that. That's a tough challenge. I don't know how I would do that. That's a very tough design challenge, but you might not be determining, you know, the user experience or the look and feel or changing the way the whole brand feels. That might not be your job at all. So even if you're brilliant and you had a great educational experience and you had great teachers and brilliant classmates, it doesn't necessarily mean the next thing that's going to happen is going to be amazing. And that's the world.
That's Jeffrey, you can't even go to a restaurant, an amazing restaurant, a 4-star restaurant, and be guaranteed that everything that you're going to be served, you're going to love.
Right.
I mean, that's the way of the world.
Right.
There's absolutely no guarantee for anything. And if you do have some happiness and if you do have something that excites you, then just try to build on that as opposed to diluting it by thinking about all the things that you don't have or that other people have that you don't have. And that's the danger with things like Facebook. I mean, I love Facebook and I love being on Facebook, but it concerns me that we're seeing so much self-editing and self-positioning because people don't want to share, you know, oh, I had a really shitty day today, or whatever it is that people are no longer feeling as.
But, you know, that's not just, I mean, don't you think in the town square, there might be people who feel uncomfortable. You know, I used to know a guy when I was in Virginia, say, how's it going, Jimmy? And he'd say, oh, can't complain. You know, and every culture has that.
Yeah,
In the England, they say mustn't grumble. So there's some people who, I mean, there's like ethnic and cultural things. There's individual personality, how much people are willing to share. But I don't know that it's necessarily Facebook that is making us.
No, you're right.
Front. I think people have always fronted.
Yeah, yes. It's humanity. We compare ourselves to each other in an effort to survive and see where we stand, literally and figuratively. And
compare and despair.
Yeah.
Everything, and this sounds corny too, but everything has to come from within. And, you know, sometimes happiness just means that you had a good orange or that you held the door open for someone without thinking about it and they smiled at you and you actually made eye contact for a second in a busy city.
Yeah.
You know, just some little thing that, you know, that's life. So now you're doing the radio show every week at Design Observer.
Yes.
What's your strategy for choosing guests now that you've done, I guess, 200 shows, maybe more?
I've done about 200. I do about 26 shows a year. So it comes out to about every other week, but I do them in pockets. So I do 13 shows in the sort of late winter, early spring, and then another 13 shows in the fall. I basically interview people that I like and admire and respect. I see my show as very celebratory. I want to celebrate what people have done, the journey that they've taken, talk to them as candidly as possible about the life that they live and the trajectory that they've had and what they've accomplished or what they've struggled with. And the criteria is simply somebody that I feel is doing work that is worthy of talking about. And so there's really no other criteria. If somebody sends me a book and I love it, I want to talk about it. If I see somebody do a lecture at a conference and I'm moved, I ask them if I can talk to them about it. I think at heart, I'm a really nosy Parker and I want to ask a million questions. And this is my way of being able to do that without being creepy.
You're also still checking the boxes. Like when you were in seventh grade and saying, it's the top 40. Have I got everything?
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's a way of celebrating what people do. It's a way of sharing, I think this person is awesome. And, you know, it's like you could like them on Facebook, but you want to be a little more active than that. You want to say, here's this person I think is amazing, doing this stuff I think is interesting. I'd like to share that with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unlike what I try to do with my students. What is so special and unique about this person that I can share or talk about or celebrate or uncover sometimes? I mean, it's really people that move me. That's the only criteria that I need to be, that I hope to be moved by something that you've done. And I'm very, very fortunate now that people write to me asking if they could be on the show. And I love to read the books and go to their lectures or listen to their music or anything that is poetic.
Well, this is great. We're running out of time. Self-Portrait as Your Traitor by Debbie Millman is the latest book, with an introduction by Paula Scher. Look Both Ways, the previous book. Design Matters is the host for Design Matters. Design Matters with Debbie Millman is hosted in Observer Media at the Design Observer Group, designobserver.com. And folks can follow you at Debbie Millman.
Yes, sir.
DebbieMillman.
Yes.
And I'll just say in closing that in spite of all your accomplishments, one of my favorite things about you is your personal brand, your bio, which just says Debbie Millman is a girl. And it's all lowercase. Love it. I love that. I love that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being on the show today.
Oh, Jeffrey, thank you. It's a true honor. Truly. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.